Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 21st, and this is our weekly news roundup. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us a little later will be Louisa Hufstadter of the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll check in with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Mike Dean up at the State House, and WCAI's Eve Zuckoff will join us in the studio. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape, the islands, the South Coast. Ethan, some homeowners in Barnstable want more regulations on short-term rentals like Airbnbs in residential neighborhoods. And it's part of a larger conversation that's going on in town around this issue.
Yeah, no, this is definitely kind of a statewide issue, but this group, it's called Barnstable Watch. It's kind of a homeowner group composed of people that are pretty much, their main thing is against investor-owned short-term rentals. So that's kind of where people go and buy. It's not their personal home. They don't live there. They go and buy up places and then just keep renting them out short-term. And kind of one of the bigger concerns is you have people, everyone knows the Cape has a very long legacy of home rentals, especially in the summer. But those usually last weeks, at least a week, usually yes. A month. It can range, but usually they're at least a week. And so they have some big concerns about kind of these 1 to 2 night kind of stays, possibly asking for bachelor parties, kind of more raucous crowd in basically neighborhoods that aren't used to this kind of thing.
And feeling like they have an impact on the quality of life in neighborhoods.
Yeah, definitely. We've heard some people, they're saying they wake up at 2 a.m. hearing raucous people next door. Whether that can happen during a weekly rental, I don't know. But it's the kind of thing, some people are very worried if you have these kind of people that are buying these homes for the sole purpose of just renting them, but that's in a residential neighborhood. Does that cross the line into a commercial purpose?
So that is one of the things this group Barnstable Watch is pointing to, saying that there's some questions around zoning that go along with this, and then regulations that they're proposing. The town itself is also proposing a set of regulations and kind of asked for citizens to weigh in. So this group has kind of said, here we are, and is waving their hands and saying, look at our regulations, which apparently are more stringent than what the town is looking at.
Yeah, so the subcommittee for the town had kind of unveiled some draft regulations, and this group seemed to really step up because they didn't feel they were strong enough. It's a similar thing to Uber, where Uber can kind of slip past a lot of local taxi regulations. These short-term rental Airbnbs have kind of done the same. Some of the things they're looking at is a ban on those investor-operated short-term rentals, requiring owner occupancy for 3 months per the year. Status quo for areas that already have a seasonal rental tradition, so places like Craigville Beach and Barnstable is a big rental area. And the minimal stays of one week per stay, limiting occupancy codes and then allowing home sharing in permitted areas while the owners are present, too, is another thing they're looking at.
And some of these recommendations, this is not the first place where people are wrestling with this issue. Some of these recommendations are based on places elsewhere that have tried to regulate this.
Yeah, so, some Cape Codders may not like it, but we're often compared to the Hamptons in Long Island in New York. These are based, they're not as strict as, but they were based on the Hamptons out in Long Island.
There's also some recommendations for an enforcement mechanism in here, which you can imagine needs to be part of the whole discussion. What's happening in Barnstable? What's the response from the town as this group has come forward and put forward these regulations?
It seems like the town's definitely willing to work with this and kind of take a look at it. I think towns usually enjoy when they have some citizen participation instead of hearing about it afterwards. I know the Osterville Village Association, which is not technically the town, but they're kind of want tighter screws on this anything goes, as they call it, nature of short-term rentals. The town definitely seems like they're amenable and willing to work with this group.
And again, they're not kind of, they say repeatedly they're not trying to cut through traditional Cape rentals. They recognize that there's a history of a tradition of renting on the Cape. This is just about these very short-term rentals in neighborhoods that typically haven't been rental neighborhoods.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's move on here. The Steamship Authority Ferry Line released some new information this week about a mishap it experienced late in January, and this has to do with their online reservation system.
Yeah, so every year, I've talked to some people, kind of, it's a holiday for them. They maybe even take off work. But every year in January, the Steamship Authority opens its online reservations for the Martha's Vineyard route, the Nantucket route too, but that never seems to be as much of a hullabaloo.
And they're not on the same day, typically.
No,
the Nantucket route
not,
is a little bit earlier than towards the end of January. There's a day when they open up summer reservations for Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, so this is for people who don't know. These reservations are to get your car over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because typically you don't need a reservation if you're just a walk-on passenger. So this is to get your car over there. And so at 5 a.m., it was late January, this day they open up and then immediately the website starts crashing. It's not working. People are all up in arms. They've been waiting for months to try and get this, and now they have doctor's appointments or something later in the day. They're planning to be up at 5 a.m.
They've set their alarm. They've gotten up early to make their reservation.
So the Steamship Authority went and looked at it. They talked to their people. Basically, the underlying cause of this was they didn't account for so many people to be trying to make reservations through their mobile website. And it was kind of absurd, the number compared to last year. So, and this actually happened in 2018. The website, there were some issues during the reservations in 2018. So in 2019, there was about 17,000 requests for reservations through the mobile site in that 5 to 5:30 half hour. This year, that was 139,000 in that same half hour period. So that kind of,
it's a tenfold increase almost, but one of the things that was happening in that first half hour this year was that almost no reservations were being booked. So it may have been that many people were just kept coming back.
Yeah, that was
back.
Kind of a question, is how many of those are the same? Is it still 17,000
right.
people that just tried it?
That are just and tried it 10 times in that half hour because they couldn't get through. But the system clearly not able to handle this.
Yeah, so they found kind of, one of the reasons was, so when the issue happened in 2018, they fixed the problem with the website with a type of connection. And then they did a bunch of load testing before this. They tried to get ready. I mean, you have to give Steamship some credit here. They tried to make sure this wasn't going to happen, but they were caught off guard by the amount of people that were going to try through the mobile site that didn't have that same new, better connection. So they're going to switch that for the next year. They're also going to take some other steps to avoid this in the future.
They point out here, the Steamship Authority pointing out that that these problems didn't result in fewer people making reservations in the end. It just really meant a lot of frustration for a lot of people that day.
Yeah, instead of getting at 5, you spent a lot of time on the website and ended up getting it around 3 or 4.
We saw tweets with stuff on social media from people trying to make those reservations that day, and many of them saying that they'd been at it for 9 hours because, you know, like you say, they got up at 5 and then wasn't until 3 o'clock in the afternoon they were able to get through, but they've been trying intermittently all that time.
Yeah, and a lot of this is to get those prime spots to get your car on. And the Steamship Authority actually had more bookings on the opening day this year than they did last year and made more money than they did last year. So
the only way to get over there. With your car that way. In New Bedford, there's word this week that the fishing boats and permits belonging to Carlos Rafael, known as the Codfather, are being sold to a company that will keep them operating out of the port there. This is pretty much the last of Carlos Rafael's fleet that's now being sold.
Yeah, so about, I think there's pretty much 95% of his fleet, which was, so Carlos Rafael was pled guilty to falsely labeling fish, smuggling cash, tax evasion, falsifying federal records, all in part of this scheme where he kind of owned the full vertical of the fishing boats and the sellers. So after that, he was ordered to kind of divest his fleet. About 95% of that done. A large portion has gone to this company called Blue Harvest Fisheries. which already had facilities in New Bedford, but also Newport News, Virginia, and Fairhaven. But they bought 12 large fishing crawlers, 27 of his permits, and his quota allocations, that's a pretty big chunk. And so this move does have some of the locals worried that this particular business, Blue Harvest Fisheries, is a privately backed invested firm. It's kind of this big business, basically. And they're worried that this can kind of change that small business kind of feel that is on the waterfront and Breen.
At the same time, New Bedford Mayor Mitchell speaking out, saying that they're just grateful in some ways that these boats are staying in New Bedford and the permits that accompany this fishing are staying in New Bedford, which means that New Bedford can rely on this business going forward. And there was a lot of concern about that, about where these boats and the permits could be going if they were broken up. But also, this company, Blue Harvest, who's bought the permits, is saying that they are going to bring a new model to all of this, and a much sort of more transparent model to how they're going to be bringing fish in and sending it to market.
Yeah, I mean, so after Carlos, who is about as untransparent as you probably could have been, they are saying they're going to employ independent dockside monitors who are going to observe 100% of the trips being offloaded and note what's coming off these vessels. So, I mean, that seems like it can be a way to make sure that something like this never happens again. And that's something that's not really being done anywhere else.
I think another part of this story is that as Carlos Rafael has sold all these boats, there's a tremendous amount of money that has come back to him. And this is somebody who's serving time now, and a lot of people feeling quite angry that, there's a number here, it reportedly has netted him $46 million in selling off his scallop fleet and his in these boats. And
so that was a prior sale, to be clear.
That was just the prior sale. That wasn't this sale. Okay.
It's unsure how much this sale price was. The Blue Harvest wouldn't tell us.
So more on top of that.
Yeah, so if it's any indication, I'm sure he's making out just fine here. And there was some talks about so his quotas, they wanted that kind of parceled out to some of the already existing fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen. But that was a thing that some people were calling for while he serves his 46-month sentence.
And interesting to note here that Blue Harvest is saying that they're not going to hire back any of the captains that had worked with Carlos Rafael on these boats.
Yeah, they don't seem interested in bringing those gentlemen back.
Hmm. Beginning on Monday, Massachusetts gets to try early voting on a presidential primary, and this is actually for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've done this in a couple elections before, early voting. So basically, you don't go in on that. You don't have to go in on just that one voting day. So
which would be March 3rd this year.
Correct. Yeah. So if you are, say you have to work a double on March 3rd or something, you can go in early. Most of it's at everyone's local town hall. And so we've done this in the 2016 presidential election and then the 2018 state election before. But this is the first one for the primary.
And at the same time this primary is being held on March 3rd, there's also a special state Senate race that's going that's really captured a lot of attention through parts of the Cape and the lower coast area.
Yeah, so this is for the Plymouth and Barnstable seat for Vinny DiMaceto, which kind of stretches down.
The seat formerly held by Vinny
DiMaceto. Yes, correct. Yeah, he stepped down. But it was held by him, and it kind of extends from like Pembroke, Plymouth, comes down to the early parts of the Cape there.
And this whole early voting thing is actually a good bit of work for local towns. It gives people the chance to go in and start voting next week for the election that comes the week following. But it is a fair amount of work for towns to mount.
Yeah, because you still have to have the same baseline apparatus of infrastructure that you're having on any election day, but you have to have it for all this time beforehand. If you ask, we asked a few town clerks, and none of them seem to be upset about that. Most of them are pretty excited because it gives people convenience. I think every town clerk is excited when people come out to vote. They're not expecting the biggest turnout for these.
I thought that was interesting, too. There's not the expectation around a presidential primary is modest.
I think part of it is because there was a short lead up to this.
In terms of the early voting?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, kind of the lead-up time to all this wasn't huge. There wasn't, like, a huge push to get out the word about it. But, I mean, whether tons of people do it or not, I think people are basically saying it's a great opportunity and convenience for people, so we should make voting all the easier.
In Wellfleet, oyster aquaculture is big business, and now a group is trying to tune up the marketing and branding game for Wellfleet oysters.
Yeah, so, I mean, Wellfleet is one of the biggest names in the game. This new group, it's called the Shellfish Promotion and Taste Inc. It's a nonprofit, is trying to make sure that that name kind of stays up there in the higher echelons of shellfishery.
And one of the things that they've done here is they've hired some consultants to come in and give them some advice about how they can market Wellfleet oysters.
Yeah, they want to make sure they're standing out in the crowd. So, I mean, they've hired an oyster expert who's going to be a brand specialist. They've hired a graphic designer and a hospitality consultant to kind of create logos for this. It's kind of, and one person kind of said, Wellfleets can stand on their own, but that doesn't mean a little marketing won't hurt. In this aspect. And I mean, it is one of the big, it's the biggest industry in Wellfleet, which is a pretty small town. I mean, I think last year there was an estimated 10 million oysters and $7.7 million in shellfish products sold. And I forget the number, but there's a ridiculous amount of Wellfleet is, if not directly involved in shellfishing, it's somehow connected.
Well, 10 million oysters coming out of Wellfleet, that is, that's a big number. It's interesting. One of the things that they're trying to do in marketing these is to simply use the word Wellfleets, call them Wellfleets, and kind of drop the oyster and market them as a one-word sort of brand that has a lot of – they keep talking about how they want to have feeling around the brand and be able to use this to sell a story to chefs and restaurants.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think whenever you go to new trendy restaurants, there's always some kind of backstory about where the chicken came from or something like that. So they're trying to get something similar here. They want people to feel a connection to I mean, you look at sometimes an oyster menu and there's 10 different oysters on there, and you're kind of like, if you're not a oyster connoisseur, you're kind of just picking blindly.
Right.
Like I would on a wine menu. So it is kind of...
But not on a beer menu.
No, I think I'd be okay. but it is one of those kind of things where if you can get people to kind of buy into your story, they're hoping to kind of really sell the name and make sure... our little town of Wellfleet keeps chugging along here.
Let me ask you quickly about another story that you covered this week. In Brewster, they are moving a little bit closer towards getting a adult-use recreational marijuana facility.
Yeah, so the Haven Center, which has been working to get a... at first, they tried to get a medical, and now they're working on a recreational facility, marijuana dispensary in Brewster on 6A there. They got one step closer. They got their approval from the planning board this week. They have the provisional approval from the state. So now they're kind of in a waiting game, waiting for final approvals from the state and make sure they do have to do some build out. But it is to get it should be interesting. Brewster has been one of the more contentious towns of back and forth. They're about almost 50-50 split on whether they want this or not. So yeah, it should be interesting to see how this goes forward, but there is no set date yet. A lot of it is worries about traffic. On 6A there, it can get pretty busy.
But they think before the end of this year, but maybe not before the end of summer. Is that right?
Yeah, so there was talks about there's a small chance during summer before, but it seemed like they more indicated it was going to be post-summer. This all came because there was talks of having them be appointment only during the summer. So they said, well, what if we open post summer, then do we have to be appointment only next summer too? So it was quite a meeting.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, thanks for coming in
this
morning.
Thanks so much,
Steve. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Earlier in the program, we talked about the Steamship Authority's issues with reservation bookings, but the ferry line was in the news on another front this week. They announced they're somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 million over budget on the renovation of the Woods Hole Terminal, a project that's now expected to run to 2025. With the story is Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette. Hiya, Louisa.
Good morning, Steve.
Louisa, more than $20 million over budget. That's a lot of money to go over budget.
Well, I'm hearing that obviously from a lot of places right now, but the fact is that it's based on a misassumption, which is that there was a budget that they went over. As a matter of fact, as our story reports, it was an estimate of costs that met that $68 million number that we began with.
Okay, so
that
they started with an estimate of $68 million.
Estimate basically on preliminary scoping, and it came out of a 2015 meeting on the Vineyard about the proposed project. That original estimate didn't include things like, for instance, moving the administrative offices away from the waterfront, which they didn't realize at the time they were going to have to do, and that was what, another $16 million rather, that they needed to spend to build their administrative center in Falmouth. Then a lot of other unforeseen things. You almost can't put a budget on a project with this many question marks. However, that nearly $93 million number is definitely raising a lot of eyebrows, and I think focusing a lot more attention on what it takes to do a project of this scope in only a few months of the year. They stopped doing the work in May. They start again in October. And so it's taking a long time and costing a lot of money.
Well, for folks who don't know, describe the scope of the work for us.
Well, I'll do my best because it really is a massive project. They've removed the old 1950s era ticket and administrative building that was originally a rail freight shed on the waterfront. They have they're splitting those functions between Falmouth and the waterfront. They are moving three slips and rebuilding them. They are completely renovating and redoing the traffic system in the parking and the staging areas. When they say that they're redoing the slips, this involves completely renovating the bulkhead, driving piles with these massive vibratory and diesel-powered hammers. They've got giant cranes in effect over there, moving these huge pieces of pipe that they need to create these so-called monopiles, which are things that help guide the ferry, you know, into its berth. The passenger piers transfer bridges, everything is being rebuilt. And the ticket office, the most controversial part of the whole plan, has gone through years of design concepts, every one of which, but the most recent, has been roundly rejected on both sides of Vineyard Sound.
So we're up to nearly $93 million as a budget for this project, but the fact is that there may be more costs to come, it sounds like.
Oh, there will be more costs to come. There are many more costs to come, and many of them are unknown. We still don't know what it will cost to build that new ticket office completely because the design is just now being finalized after passing in concept. The unknowns that are beneath the land that's beneath the water, if you know what I mean. The contractor, Jay Cashman of Quincy, the contract they worked out with the Steamship Authority in order to be anywhere near something that could be afforded, limits the contractor's responsibility to, I believe it's 10 feet beneath the soil, beneath the surface. And if they run into anything past that deep that they have to detour around while they're excavating, for instance, or putting in piles, that's on the Steamship Authority. And there really is no way, for instance, there was no way for them to know what lay beneath that old freight and ticket building until they got down there. And sure enough, they were hitting into undersoil ledges that they had to maneuver around and work with, and we still don't know what's yet to come underneath there. The sea bottom holds a lot of surprises.
And real briefly, what is the timeline that they're looking at now to try to wrap this project up?
Well, they didn't mention that during Wednesday's meeting, and so when public comment came around, I thought it would be a good idea to ask. And Bob Davis looked over some papers and said it looks like the best-case scenario would be the beginning of the summer season, May of 2025.
And this has been going on already a couple of years.
Yeah, they started at the beginning of 2018, a little bit behind schedule, but nothing in the larger scheme of things.
Louisa Hufstadter from the Vineyard Gazette. Louisa, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Provincetown, like so many towns around the region, has its share of old houses that, when they get sold, are in jeopardy of being torn down for a bigger, newer house. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent joins us now with the story of how one house is being saved and the people with the passion behind the project. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Casey, this house belonged to a well-known author. Tell us about the author and the house.
Sure. This is Mary Heaton Vorse's house. She was a well-known author and journalist who lived at 466 Commercial Street from 1907 to 1966 until her death at 92. And her time in the town, which she actually wrote a book about with the same title, was kind of a favorite time in Provincetown's history when poor but loving fishing community opened itself up to poor but talented artists from all over. And she kind of embodied that time period and wrote really well about it. And I think people still hold on to that particular identity of Provincetown that she was so well known for writing about. And after she died, her son stayed in that house on Commercial Street. And, you know, at some point when he died, it was threatened, just like you said in your introduction, of being taken over and gutted and spiffied up and totally changed from what it was to from a large but very kind of like bohemian home into what so many Provincetown homes come when they just look kind of perfect, but they're too perfect. So Mary's granddaughters approached Ken Folk, who is a celebrated interior designer, very well known in town and in many other parts of the country, and he specializes in historic preservation. And he took it on and is in the process of restoring the home to, as he says, it's going to look like they didn't do anything to it when it's done. So that's kind of thrilling. He's salvaged the bathroom plumbing and restored the windows by hand using the single panes of glass. He and his contractor, I should say, Nate McKean, and all the floorboards have come up and they were each numbered so we could put in a new foundation and lay each one down again. It'll have 7 bedrooms and it's expected to be done by May.
And one of the unique things about this project is the idea of what's going to happen to this house when it's done. This is not just going to be sold for somebody's house here.
Exactly, yes. And he has kind of an open concept. He hasn't quite defined what he's going to do with it, but certainly part of it is going to be to support the different artist communities in town. He's going to have it opened up for residencies with the Provincetown Art Association, the Provincetown Film Society, 20 Summers. And when he dies someday, even though he's not that old, he's going to leave it to an arts organization as well. And he kind of describes the future of the house as saying, you know, it's a private home, but he's going to take a bohemian, relaxed approach to all of this, which Mary Heaton Vorse would love. It'll be a very Provincetown moment, he told our reporter, of just opening the doors and allowing the community to come in.
That is Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
The April election ballot is set on Nantucket, and it appears to reflect a downward trend in candidate participation. Josh Balling has the story from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, tell us what's happening here. There are only 2 contested races on the upcoming ballot.
There are. There are the races for select board and planning board, and with less than 24 hours to go before the deadline to submit nomination papers, there was actually only 1 contested race for select board, but a candidate did come forward to challenge the incumbent of the planning board race at the 11th hour, so there'll be those 2 contested races. But we looked into it, and this is actually reflecting a downward trend that goes back at least 4 years. Last year, there were 3 contested races for select board, the land bank commission, and the planning board. In 2018, there were 4, and in 2017, there were 5. And town officials are a little bit concerned about this, and as are some local government watchers. They are concerned that there's too many elected bodies out there that either are struggling to find anyone to run, or the incumbents continue to return to those races. And first-term select board member. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Well, what do they think is the issue here that may be contributing to this downward trend of participation?
There are a couple of theories. One seems to be a general discontent with the service of town government right now, but more town officials actually think that it simply comes down to time commitment, that it's time-consuming to run and to serve in public office in a town like Nantucket, which is essentially a $100 million corporation governed by volunteers. And boards like the Select Board, the Planning Board, sometimes meet for 3 or 4 hours at a time, at least a couple of times a month, sometimes more. The Select Board members say that to do their job well and appropriately, they have to work 30 or 40 hours a week, just to do that, between meetings and distilling and disseminating all the information, and serving on subcommittees. And for, you know, somebody who has a family, somebody who has a full-time job to support a family on Nantucket, that's hard to do. So that they're really looking at ways, not necessarily to increase participation, but to figure out how that can change. There's a town government study committee that's currently looking perhaps at other forms of town government, including a paid or elected city council or mayoral system.
I want to ask you about another story you have in the paper this week. It's about a bike share program that's coming to the island, but it brings with it a number of questions.
It does. Most people are probably familiar with bike share programs more often in big cities. You see them in Boston and New York, other places like that. But one is coming to Nantucket as well. Earlier this month, the Select Board awarded a company called Sandy Pedals a one-year permit to operate on town property starting around Memorial Day. Owner Tom Holt says he plans to start with about 75 to 100 bicycles distributed among a number of locations downtown and around the island that haven't yet been determined. And the way bike share works is that there's no real bike shop you rent from. You pick up a bike from a location that is digitally enclosed inside what's called a geofence. And once you put your credit card information in, you're on the clock. And once you bring it back to one of those geofenced areas, either the same one or another one, you're off the clock. And that's how you pay. The concern here is there's a couple. Some bike shop owners themselves are worried about an even playing field, much like restaurant owners have expressed concern in the past about food trucks. They say that the costs are different. Brick and mortar costs more, and they're worried that the bike share program may take some of their business away. Others are concerned that downtown Nantucket can get pretty congested in the summertime especially, and if these geofenced areas don't work the way they're supposed to, or if they're the bikes aren't properly put away, it could congest some of the downtown streets and sidewalks. But proponents say this is a great way to encourage people to get downtown in another way than using a car, ease up some of the traffic congestion, and perhaps encourage workers downtown to use the bike share if they don't have their own bicycles to get downtown, and they also wouldn't have to worry about bringing a car into town.
But this is coming this summer.
This is coming. Despite the concerns, this is coming with about 75 to 100 bikes. You'll see them downtown around Memorial Day and out at the beaches and wherever else. And these bikes, by the way, are pedal-assist bikes. They are not just simple bicycles. They actually have a top speed of around 20 miles an hour, which is kind of hard to get to with pedal-assist, but it can be done. Town officials, it's another little bit of a concern. They're worried about the speed, but they're talking with the owner, Tom Holt, about perhaps finding a way to put some kind of governor on the bicycle so that top speed couldn't be reached.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. The Beach Road Weekend Music Festival will be returning to Vineyard Haven this year. Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times has details. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Steve.
Brian, last year was the first year for this, and it was billed as a kind of a trial year, but the verdict seems to be, bring it on. They're coming back this year, and it's going to be bigger.
Yeah, last year, Beach Road Weekend was a huge success. It went off without a hitch. Adam Epstein, who's the mastermind behind the whole thing, said that he definitely had wanted to come back this year, and now he is, and he's got this great slate of artists ready to play. It's going to feature Beck, Nora Jones, Lake Street Dive, the Revivalists, the Head and the Heart. There's about, I think, 30 acts or so. And he was talking to WMVY, the local radio station here, and he was saying that last year was really just a dress rehearsal for kind of what they're putting on the stage this year. And he also said they're going to change some things up. So they're going to have two main stages right next to each other, which will kind of create this streamlined performance. So, you know, one band's going to play. As soon as they're done, the next band's going to go. And he just said music's going to be playing all weekend.
And they have some other ideas about how they're going to organize it a little bit differently this year, it sounds like.
Yeah. And along with those stages, they're going to have, they kind of had a seating area last year which they got rid of, so they cleared that out. So the general admission is just going to be one big area in front of the main stages so that, you know, people can pack in as close as they want. Also, he actually just got recent approval to do another screening of Jaws, which was a big hit. He had Jaws up on the big screen at the festival, and there was a live orchestra, and I think he's still trying to figure out that piece of it. But, yeah, he's got approved for it, and tickets go on sale today.
And this is the third weekend in July, it looks like.
Yep, it's going to run from July, the Jaws showing is going to be on July 23rd, but the festival itself is going to be the 24th, 25th, and the 26th of July.
Let me ask you about another article you have in the paper about an Edgartown couple who have returned home from a cruise and concerns about potential contact with the coronavirus.
Yeah, so Tom and Diane Durawa are an Edgartown couple. They were on the luxury cruise liner Westerdam, which I'm sure many people recognize the name as. The cruise ship that was going around Asia and was having trouble finding a port that they could get into because of fears that of the coronavirus. But they eventually got off and got their way back home. And people were screened on that ship. They were tested for it, and the Durawas, of course, had their test came back negative. They didn't have it. But there were some questions raised about the screening methods on board because a person later was found to have tested positive.
One of the other passengers that disembarked was later found to have this virus, right?
Correct, yeah. They tested positive for the coronavirus. The Diane Durawa spoke to the Times this week and told us that they, you know, while they were on the ship, they had undergone numerous health checks were cleared to leave. And now that they're back, the Edgartown health agent, Matt Poole, has said that, you know, he's working with state and local officials, and the town administrator is in on this too. So they're monitoring this, and they say that the Durawas are very, very low risk, and they're kind of self-quarantining themselves in their home anyways just to make sure. Matt Poole, the health agent, just, you know, told people, you know, wash your hands, sneeze into your arm, and just use kind of common sense health practices that you would with influenza.
Mm-hmm. That's Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
The big news on Beacon Hill this week was not about legislation. A longtime representative and member of the House Ethics Committee was arrested on a long list of corruption charges. Earlier, I talked with WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean about the case. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning.
Mike, this is David Nangle, who's a state representative from Lowell. He was arrested this week on more than two dozen charges, including using campaign funds to conceal debt, fund casino trips, and pay for golf club memberships. This week, he resigned from a couple of posts, including from the committee whose job it may be to investigate these charges.
Yeah, he's a Democrat from Lowell. Like you said, he's been in the House since 1999, so he's one of the more senior members. And up until yesterday, he was a pretty high-ranking member of Speaker Robert DeLeo's leadership team. He was a floor division chair, which is one of four representatives that kind of whip votes and coordinate, you know, different kinds of, you know, votes on the floor of the House. So he was in that pretty tight circle of DeLeo's leaders that is mostly taken from these veteran lawmakers that have been around for a while. You know, Nangle also resigned this week from the Ethics Committee, which I think, as you said, is the committee that would look into infractions like this. Now, it's not clear right now whether or not that committee or Speaker DeLeo is going to order that committee to look into Nangle for these allegations. Occasionally, when there is kind of a federal case being made, like there is right now from U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling, the legislature's own investigation might take a back seat or might take a little while later, or, you know, they'll let a conviction or a not guilty finding carry out without looking at things themselves. However, he is accused of having violated House rules, especially those campaign spending items that you said. It's obviously a lot deeper than this. He's accused of wire fraud, defrauding banks and the IRS, a lot having to do with this gambling debt. That's come as a shock to a lot of people on Beacon Hill who really had no idea that Nangle was in deep with any kind of debt. The way Lelling put it in the indictment in the press conferences that Nangle was just using his political influences in a number of ways, in systemic ways, to support a lifestyle that he just couldn't afford.
One of the things that Andrew Lelling, the U.S. attorney, is pointing to here is he's saying that these charges aren't indicative of what he calls a momentary loss of judgment, that this really represents a long pattern of Nangle behaving in this way.
Yeah, this has been going on for years. The FBI has been tracking Nangle and investigating him for years and years, it seems like. The House did admit that they had responded to a federal grand jury subpoena. They didn't reveal what that subpoena was, what the information was that they offered up to the federal grand jury, or even if they knew it was about Nangle. It could have been some kind of financial documents or anything like that. It's important to remember here that virtually nothing in the legislature is open to public record. So that is something that federal authorities would need to subpoena in order to get access to any kind of spending record for the House itself or for House offices, members' offices is completely under wraps. The public does not have access to that the way they would in other states. So that is one thing that we learned in the fallout from all of this. But you're right. Lelling, the U.S. attorney, does describe it as a systemic pattern of theft and fraud to cover these gambling debts, to kind of cover the lifestyle that he was describing in this indictment. And it seems like Nangle had more than a few different arrangements and is alleged to have had more than a handful of different kinds of fraud going on in order to make this whole thing work.
Now, another interesting piece of this case is that Nangle, as you've said, has been a close associate of House Speaker Robert DeLeo. So tell us, what's DeLeo been saying about the case?
Very little. I was actually quite surprised myself how long it took for House officials to respond to this. He was arrested in the morning. Lelling's office put out an email around 9:30, I believe it was, saying that this was going to happen, and the arraignment was, I believe, in the 10 o'clock hour. And we didn't hear from really anyone at the House of Representatives until much, much later. I believe it was around 4:30 p.m. The Speaker made a very brief comment via email sent out to the press. He did not appear in person, saying that he was, shocked and disappointed. He expressed that he had no idea about gambling addiction or gambling debt, said that, they've been friends for 20 years since Nangle joined the House. Like I said, he admitted that the House did cooperate with the grand jury subpoena, and that's really all we know about this. DeLeo has not been seen in the State House, as far as I know, yet. So it's important to remember this is school vacation week. There's very few folks in the State House anyway. A lot of members use this week to take vacation themselves before a lot of lawmaking will start up this spring.
That's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
Seven candidates are competing for the Plymouth Barnstable State Senate seat, recently vacated by Republican Vinny DiMacedo. At a nonpartisan forum this week, the candidates tried to distinguish themselves with solutions for climate change. WCAI's climate and environment reporter Eve Zuckoff was there and joins me now. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
First, we've been talking to the candidates individually here on WCAI, but remind us who's running and what that district actually entails.
Yeah, so seven is a lot of candidates, so we'll go through quickly. Susan Moran is a Falmouth selectman, town's representative to the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates. There's also Becky Coletta, a lawyer from Pembroke, John Mahoney, Plymouth selectman, Thomas Moakley, youngest candidate at 25, he's of West Falmouth, Stephen Michael Palmer of Plymouth. And then there are two Republicans, and it's worth noting they were not at the forum. They did not attend, but those two Republicans are Jay McMahon III, he's a lawyer from Bourne, and Jesse Brown, a Plymouth business owner and veteran.
They were invited but did not attend.
That's correct.
So the night of this forum, what kinds of policies did the candidates get into? What were they talking about?
Yeah, so, I mean, when we talk about climate change, when we talk about policy, typically what we're really talking about is renewable energy, clean water, bridges, transportation, mass transit. So that's kind of, you know, we didn't sit there talking about science the entire night. We really did get into policy. And for the most part, all of these candidates really were in agreement. We need more and better mass transit. Some of them really called on getting a better rail system. Susan Moran really went hard on the idea that we could be building a new bridge to come, you know, new bridges. And if they don't have a rail, it's not really setting us up but well for mass transit. Others focused on the idea that we need battery storage here on the Cape when it comes to renewable energy. Wasn't a ton of disagreement, I have to say.
Was it hard for candidates to make themselves in that kind of a discussion?
Well, I think that there were some opportunities to, and I think the main place that they did that was through their personal narrative and through the way that they said they would accomplish things on Beacon Hill. So, all of them agreed to support additional offshore wind procurements. They all said the state should increase funding for environmental agencies. The state should divest pensions from investments related to fossil fuels. But then when it came down to other kinds of topics, like John Mahoney, he was the only candidate to hesitate on a question of whether he'd oppose new infrastructure for natural gas pipelines, as we've seen in Weymouth. That has been a major issue. So really, when it came to policy, they were not distinguishing themselves, and they knew that. They weren't disagreeing with each other. It was a very civil forum. Mm-hmm. But when it came to time to say, here's who I am, that's where they found some room to say, you know, I've lived in Plymouth my entire life. Here's what I've seen in Plymouth. I am the daughter of a disabled veteran. I'm a 25-year-old who's going to think about the next 75 years of climate policy. That's where they really were able to shine as individuals.
Tell me a little bit about the audience for this forum. Who comes out to spend an evening with the climates listening to them? To spend an evening with the candidates listening to them talk about climate policy.
Yeah, well, the event itself was sponsored by the Wildlands Trust, Sierra Club, Association to Preserve Cape Cod. So it was a lot of environmental activists who were there, older crowd, but it was standing room only. I mean, there were 100 people and the entire room was absolutely packed. In the beginning, there was actually a shuffle where the head of the Wildlands Trust said, if you're young and you're in a seat right now, consider standing. So older crowd, but all really, really focused on environmental action. And it's a group that votes. So it was an important crowd to be captured by a candidate.
And briefly, the two Republican candidates who didn't attend, what do we know about them and their positions here and what the response was to the evening?
Yeah, well, because WCAI has spoken with both these candidates, we know a little bit about them. But, you know, a representative for Jay McMahon said of last night that he is committed to protecting the environment, but he's not supportive of gas taxes, for example. Jesse Brown, the other Republican candidate, is in the same boat on that. But the reason Jay McMahon did not attend is that he had a previously scheduled speaking engagement. We've reached out to Jesse Brown's campaign in a number of ways and haven't heard back, but we'll update online if we do.
That is WCAI's environment and climate reporter, Eve Zilkoff. Eve, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is the news roundup for this week. I want to thank my guest, Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with Louisa Hufstadter at the Vineyard Gazette, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. We checked in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we heard from Mike Dean, WCAI Statehouse reporter. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.